This is the first day. This is the first day of this December 2011 four-day session. And we're going to start by reading from a text called Daikaku's Treatise on Meditation. This is from a little book published quite a while ago called The Original Face, an Anthology of Rinzai Zen. Now this this master who's listed here, Daikaku, is once again, he's actually a Chinese master. Daikaku is a Japanese name. It's his Japanized name. But his original Chinese name is Rangke Doryu. Now hold on, that's another Japanese name. it's his original Chinese name is Lanshi Daolong. And because Daolong is not that difficult a name to pronounce, I'm going to go with the Chinese, because that's what he went with, his Chinese name. He was a contemporary of Japanese Zen master Dogen. His dates are 1213 to 1279. So we're reading here from the introduction. He was born and began his studies in Western China. He studied the Buddhist sutras in various places, and then he went on to train with several Chan masters and finally realized enlightenment with a master Wu Ming Hui Xing. He then heard that Zen was not well known in Japan, even though other Buddhist teachings were flourishing there in Japan, but he wanted to introduce them to Zen or Chan, and so he crossed the sea with several disciples. Actually, it refers here to him as Master Lan Shi, so that's probably his last name. Let's use Lan Shi. So Daikaku, his Chinese name is Lan Shi. At this time, he was 33 years old, and he spent another 33 years teaching in Japan. He died when he was 66, and he left some 24 enlightened successors. That's the only biographical material I could find on this Lan Shi. So now to the text itself. Zen Master Lan Shi's Treatise on Sitting Meditation. And there's some introductory words by him, presumably. Sitting meditation is the method of great liberation. All the teachings flow forth from this. Myriad practices are mastered this way. Supernormal powers, knowledge, wisdom and virtue all arise from here. The path of life of humans and gods opens herein. All the Buddhas have entered and left by this door. Bodhisattvas practicing it have entered this door. So we just said it in reciting the Hakuin chant, upholding the precepts, repentance, and giving the countless good deeds. And the way of right living all come from Zazen. Whatever esoteric or exoteric schools do not practice this, do not have anyone who realizes the way of Buddhahood. I don't know, this sounds a little dubious, a little, dare I say, biased in favor of the Zen school. If you read it as it appears, whatever other schools don't practice Zazen, don't have anyone who realizes the way of Buddhahood, it would seem to be really untrue. You can be sure that there are those in Tibetan Buddhism and other schools of Buddhism and other traditions besides Buddhism who may well, presumably, have realized the way of Buddhahood. I don't know if meditation is always part of Tibetan Buddhist practice. I know that it doesn't have the sitting. Sitting meditation does not have the same central position in Tibetan Buddhism, in many Tibetan Buddhist lineages, as it does in Zen. Although I have heard from a couple of sources that the Dalai Lama begins each day with 6 hours of meditation. Gets up at, as I have heard it, gets up at 2:30 or 3 in the morning. This reference to the path, he says, the path of the life of humans and gods opens herein. These are the two highest of the six realms of unenlightened existence. And they're often paired, these two realms of the human realm and the deva realm, or the heavenly realm, as the realm of those who are harvesting some especially good karma. There are various texts that refer to humans and gods, or men and devas. It's another way they put it. Then the rest of this is in dialogue form. Question: what does it mean that sitting meditation is the root source of all the teachings? And then Lan Shi says, meditation is the inner mind of the enlightened ones. Discipline is their outer character. Doctrine is their speech. Buddha remembrance is the invocation of Buddha's name. All come from the enlightened mind of the Buddhas. Therefore, it is considered fundamental. It, meaning the enlightened mind of the Buddhas, is considered fundamental. Or meditation, excuse me. Meditation is considered fundamental. Let's break this down. Meditation is the inner mind of the enlightened ones. By meditation, he means a mind of awareness, stabilized awareness. That's our nature. The traditional word for this mind of stabilized awareness or enlightened awareness is Buddha. So he's really talking here about Buddha nature. Buddha nature, Buddha mind, is the inner mind of the enlightened ones. Discipline is their outer character. Discipline here is one way that the Sanskrit word shila is sometimes translated, or morality. Discipline is one translation, morality is another one. But this is a wonderful thing to appreciate, that discipline or morality is the outer character of the enlightened ones. Many of you have heard me say this many times, as I heard Roshi Kaplow say, that the precepts which articulate Shila, or morality, or discipline. The precepts describe the way, the conduct of a fully enlightened one, a Buddha. And then doctrine is their speech, which points to the when we are in harmony with the Dharma, then we are in harmony with doctrine, the Buddhist doctrine, the sutras, and that becomes what we present verbally. All of these come from the enlightened mind of the Buddhas. Or we could say, come from sounds sequential when it's put that way, that first there's the enlightened mind and then comes meditation, discipline, doctrine, and so forth. It's really, these reflect the enlightened, our own enlightened mind, our enlightened Buddha nature. Question. The method of meditation is formless and thoughtless. Spiritual qualities are not obvious, and there is no proof of seeing reality. So how can we believe in this? So this, just to look again at the question, the method of meditation, Zazen, is formless, meaning we don't want to cling to any thought forms, and thoughtless, same thing. When we are not clinging to thought forms, then we are free of thoughts. But the questioner seems to see this as being awfully devoid of any substance to it. It's formless, thoughtless. Spiritual qualities are not obvious. There is no proof of seeing reality. So how can we believe in this? And then Lan Shi, your own mind and the enlightened mind are one. Is that not spiritual quality? If you don't know your own mind, on whom can you call for witness and proof? Other than the identity of mind and Buddha, what proof do you seek? To go to the questioner's last question, how can we believe in this? If we practice it diligently, devotedly, daily, we don't need to believe in it as a belief system. We just need to see how we change. It's very different. Experience is different from belief. Belief is another thought form, holding something in the mind, a belief in something. But through practice, we don't have to hold anything in the mind. We can see the effects of doing meditation. Question. How can the ability to cultivate the teaching of one mind compare to myriad practices cultivating myriad virtues? So he's referring there to the many other kinds of Buddhist practices besides meditation. But Lan Shi responds, when you suddenly awaken to the pure, clear meditation of those who realize thusness, the six transcendences and myriad practices are complete within your body. Thus, the one practice of meditation includes all practices. Haven't you heard it said that the three realms are only one mind, that outside of mind there is nothing else? Even if you do cultivate myriad practices, if you don't know the mind, you cannot realize enlightenment. And how can there be any way to fulfill the way of the Buddha if you don't realize enlightenment? On my on one of my pilgrimages, the longer one where I spent 9 months in Asia, traveling through Japan and China and Tibet, I ran into one or two people in the Tibetan tradition, Tibetans, who raised a question about Zen because it has just this one practice of meditation, whereas in Tibetan Buddhism there are all kinds of practices of visualizing things, and there are prostrations, there are different kinds of prayer practices, there are many kinds of meditation. And this would be an answer, what Lan Shi offers here. Even if you do cultivate myriad practices, if you don't know the mind, you cannot realize enlightenment. The practice, he says, the one practice of meditation includes all practices. Well, there are those who, for whom that makes complete sense, and that's us here. And then there are those who need to be able to try and move through different kinds of practices. And so, wonderful, we have the many kinds of practice, of Tibetan Buddhist practice, and we have this core, simple practice of Zen meditation. And there are different ways for different people. When I was beginning my sitting, my first year of sitting, when I was still living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, I hadn't moved to the center yet. There was Gary Snyder was visiting as a visiting poet at the University of Michigan, and we were able, not to go into too much detail, but we were able to have breakfast with him in the home of his host, Donald Hall, another poet. And during the question period, after after breakfast, he took questions from us. All of us, none of us had been sitting for more than a few months. And the one guy among us said, what's the difference between Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism? And his answer still sticks with me, because I still think it's a good answer. He said, he used a metaphor. Now, by the way, at this point, Gary Snyder had already spent 8 years in Rinzai temples and training in Rinzai monasteries in Japan. So he had a lot of experience behind him. And he said, if you think of the mind as a pond, in Tibetan Buddhism, it's like moving, getting into the water and moving around in that pond and looking at all the different aspects of it. Swimming down and circling around through the perimeter of the pond, the circumference of it, the contours of underwater, the underwater life, the plant life, the sea life, the quality of the water, the different, and by exploring this pond in so much detail and its many different facets, it takes a long time to get to the bottom. But once you get to the bottom, then you really know that pond. Whereas in Zen, the emphasis is on just diving straight down to the bottom. Getting to the bottom. It is Kensho. And then, on the way up, then you take more time. For example, working through the whole koan curriculum, you examine all the different aspects of mind. Now, I would just add that the longer you spend, even spend with one of these simple Zen practices, when I say simple, I don't mean easy, but I mean just very uncomplicated, you know, the breath or a koan, the longer you spend following the breath or working on a first koan, the better you're going to get to know that pond. So it's not a perfect distinction between Tibetan Buddhism and Zen. But the emphasis in Zen is keeping it simple, keeping it uncluttered, uncomplicated, just cutting through to the ground. Question: how should we practice this method? Even if we practice, we are not sure of attaining enlightenment and fulfilling Buddhahood. And if it's uncertain, even if we do practice, what is the benefit? I hope that everyone here can appreciate how this questioner is in error here. Basically, he's saying, well, if we can't get to enlightenment, then why practice? Well, I think everyone here knows that there are a lot of benefits, a lot of wisdom that we uncover short of enlightenment, short of Kensho, through practice. But then let's go to Lanchi's answer. This school, that is Zen, is an exceedingly deep and subtle teaching. Once you have heard it, it becomes an excellent cause for enlightenment for all time. An ancient said, those who hear this, even if they don't believe, have blessings greater than humans or gods. Those who practice even without attainment eventually reach Buddhahood. So he's saying, even leaving aside the many secondary benefits of daily sitting and long practice, even aside from those, we still are moving ever closer to our eventual enlightenment, which, if it doesn't come in this lifetime, is sure to come in a future one. So for those who want to get something from their practice, he says, this is what you are heading for. Eventually reach Buddhahood. Of course, that is a matter of faith or belief. What we know from experience, what we don't need to hold on the basis of belief, is the benefits that come from a practice of meditation. And then Lanshi continues with his answer. This teaching is the school of the enlightened mind. The enlightened mind itself, basically, has no delusion or enlightenment. So here he's now, he's getting to the essential point, the essential mistake in the questioner, in the question, which is that to even think in terms of enlightenment and no enlightenment, or delusion here and now, and then enlightenment out in the future, this is a mistake. The enlightened mind itself basically has no delusion or enlightenment. This is actually the subtle art of those who realize thusness. Even if you don't become enlightened, when you sit once in meditation, you are a Buddha for that sitting. When you sit for a day in meditation, you're a Buddha for a day. When you sit in meditation all your life, you are a Buddha all your life. The same is true of the future. One who can have faith in this is someone with great potential. So this is a great, great anchor of faith, is to have faith that in our sitting, or not just sitting, in our mind of meditation, even daily activities, we are actualizing our Buddha nature, our enlightened nature. It's not before and after. It's not sequential. It's not just cause and effect. If I do this, then I'll get that. It's in doing this, we are actualizing our Buddha nature. And then the question, another question. If so, I can practice too. How should I rest my mind? How should I use my mind? Lanshi. The enlightened mind has no attachment to appearances. Detachment from appearances is the character of reality. Now let's just pause here. No attachment to appearances. Detachment from appearances is the character of reality. So this is the basic teaching of our school, is that we are deceived by this world of appearances, this world of objects, this world of phenomena. But coexisting with this world, this conventional reality of thingness, is this realm of no thingness. That's what liberates us, is the direct experience of the no thingness of things. Shunyata, emptiness. The one sentence in the Lankavatara Sutra that I know by heart because it's so profound is, things are not what they appear to be, nor are they otherwise. If we stop and just say things are illusory, that's half the truth. It's not the whole truth. And things are also things. He goes on, among the four modes of conduct, And this is another just traditional formulation of different ways of being. Walking, standing, sitting, and lying. Sitting is considered to be stable and tranquil. This means sitting straight and contemplating the characteristics of reality. Okay, so for anyone who isn't clear about this, the reason we sit in these stable postures, stable, straight postures, is because it's the easiest way to keep the mind concentrated or free of thoughts. It's not that there's anything special about sitting, other than the fact that sitting is as difficult as meditation is while sitting, it's easier, it's less difficult than when we're moving around or lying down. When the limbs are drawn up toward the center of the body in any one of these different postures that everyone uses, when the limbs are drawn up toward the center, then we become more centered. That's why we sit, so much in sesshin, because it makes it a little easier. It gives us a leg up in our efforts at concentrating the mind. So his last thing is, he refers to contemplating, sitting straight and contemplating the characteristics of reality. Question. Please explain in detail the meaning of sitting straight and contemplating reality. Sitting straight means sitting cross-legged as the Buddhas do. Contemplating reality means sitting meditation, forming the symbol of absorption in the cosmos. That's the classic hand mudra, hand position, where we form an oval with the tips of the thumbs lightly touching. The symbol of absorption in the cosmos, body and mind unmoving, eyes half open. You should see all compounded things as like dreams, illusions, bubbles, shadows. Don't get hung up in thought about them. Well, that's the important thing. Don't get hung up in thought about them. In Zen, we're not trying to imagine things as dreams or illusions or bubbles. That's a practice of imagining. That's not Zen practice. It's easier to put it in the negative. So don't cling to things, thoughts, and other things. Question. Crossing the legs and making the symbol with the hands is the comportment of the realized ones, but why keep the eyes half open? And then he answers, when the eyes are fully open and you can see for a distance, your mind can be distracted by the profusion of objects. But if you close your eyes, you fall into a state of darkness and oblivion, and your mind is not clear. When your eyes are half open, your thoughts don't race. Mind and body are one thusness. When you examine clearly, the afflictions of birth and death cannot be approached. This is called fulfilling Buddhahood right where you are, the meaning of great capacity and great function. This is really important what he's talking about, not letting your eyes close during sitting. We all know how difficult that can be when we're already a bit drowsy, then the eyelids tend to droop, the eyes tend to close or almost close, but then that makes us more drowsy. So how do you get out of that cycle? Well, you just really learn to prevent the eyes from closing during Zazen. when the eyes are even half open, then the light reaches the retina of the eyes, and this keeps us more alert. So I really want to emphasize these first 2 days of any sesshin, there are a lot of people who are fighting off drowsiness, and whatever it takes, you have to be sure the eyes are not closing. Then you don't stand a chance. Question. Though I hear what you say, it's still hard to really believe. Only by accumulating the virtues of reading and reciting sutras and dharani, fasting, discipline, recitation of Buddha names, can we have something to rely on. How can there be anything special about peaceful meditation without doing anything? Again, the words of Hakuin, upholding the precepts, repentance, and giving, the countless good deeds, the way of right living, and we can add here fasting, reciting sutras, reading, all come from Zazen. The questioner here is honest. Though I hear what you say, it's still hard to really believe. to practice Zen means to believe ultimately that there's nothing we need to do. There's no change that we need to effect. There's nothing we need to do. What we're doing in Zazen, rather, is allowing thoughts to settle, allowing the mind to come to rest. I suppose you could say that's doing something, but only in a very broad sense. It's clear when we compare Zen meditation to other kinds of meditation. For example, metta meditation, you try to radiate loving kindness. You're trying to broadcast loving kindness. It's different. We're not trying to do that in Zen. We're not trying to radiate loving kindness. We're not trying to summon up gratitude. We're not trying to do anything. We're allowing the mind to settle. And the mind will settle more readily if we can keep our attention focused on the breath or the koan or whatever it is we're doing, which are just different means of detaching from objects, thought objects. But it all comes down to just letting things be as they are. Because remember, Buddha is our nature. Enlightenment is our nature. Why would we want to change that? We just need to get out of the way, let the mind settle, and everything flows from that. But the questioner is asking specifically about all these other practices. These other practices, reading and reciting sutras and fasting and working on the precepts and so forth, these are all ways of accumulating merit. The translator here, renders this, he says, accumulating the virtues of reading and reciting sutras and drawing and so forth. The traditional word is merit. That when you've piled up enough merit, when you've acquired enough merit in your karmic bank account, as the thinking goes, then you're ready to awaken. Lanshi answers, such doubt is called activity causing birth and death. Such doubt is called affliction. Practicing everything without any sense of attainment is called the exceedingly profound transcendent wisdom. This wisdom can cut off the source of birth and death like a sharp sword. To practice virtue in hopes of reward is the illusion of ordinary people. Bodhisattvas do not seek for the resulting rewards as they cultivate roots of virtue, because they cultivate goodness for the sake of impartial love and compassion, and thus it becomes sustenance for enlightenment. So when we do it for its own sake, when we do this practice of attention, this no-minded attention, then it becomes sustenance, it becomes the nourishment, the fuel for enlightenment. This is you can't get any more fundamental in terms of the point of sitting. So long as we see sitting as a means to an end, then we will be impeded. But once we see the sitting, let's make that the breath practice or the koan or shikantaza, once we see this as doing these practices for their own sake, for their ultimate value, without any idea of them leading to anything, once we can really put our whole mind into the breath for its own sake, just the breath, mu for its own sake, just mu, and so forth, that's when things will really unfold and really open up for us. It's very difficult, especially if it's painful, if we have physical pain in our legs, our back, hips, ankles, whatever. If we have physical pain, then it's very difficult not to want something from it. We're going to go through this sacrifice and this pain, then I want results. But we got to forget results. To get results, we got to forget results. And that's hard. That's very hard. Because our whole lives, we've been conditioned to exert ourselves, to make effort, to work with the expectation of results. And now we come to practice, and we have to give it up. We have to relinquish it. That is, relinquish the notion of results. And just lose ourselves completely in this single practice of the breath, of the koan, or whatever it is. So it calls for a great deal of purity to work this way for its own sake, not to get anything. And then he ends, as for those who seek rewards as they cultivate virtue and attain the lesser reward of humanity and godhood, this is surely the work of birth and death. Here again, this allusion to humans and gods, or humans and devas, these two highest levels of unenlightened existence. In Buddhist psychology, it's acknowledged that even if you're doing something good, something virtuous for merit, to build up your storehouse of merit, that you still will are more likely to reach a favorable rebirth into one of these two highest realms of unenlightened existence. But it's still unenlightened. It's still unenlightened so long as we are thinking in the future and trying to do something for our own spiritual profit. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.